Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room. I'm Andrew Hill. Today we are privileged to have with us Major General John S. Kem, who is the 51st Commandant of the United States Army War College. General Kem, welcome to the War Room podcast.
It's great to be here.
So by way of introduction, General Kem is a 1985 graduate of the United States Military Academy. He also has a Master's of Science in Environmental Engineering from Northwestern University and an MBA from the Kellogg School at Northwestern University. As a Harvard Business School grad, I will not hold that against you. That's a wonderful place. He assumed command of the Army War College in August 2017 after recently serving as the first provost of the Army University and deputy commandant of the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth during his many years of service as an engineering officer. He served in Iraq and in many important positions elsewhere. And sort of that's a segue into our conversation today, which is about leader development. Sir, as the Commandant of the United States Army War College, one of the key roles of the War College is to prepare field grade officers for leadership at the senior, at the strategic level. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about a leader you admire, someone that you, it could be someone you know or a historical figure that you admire, and what made them effective in your mind as a leader.
I don't know if I have any one particular person that really jumps to mind. I really tend to be a bring together amalgam of people. I think early on when I was growing up and I went to West Point, I think early on I really admired MacArthur, really because of the way he really was a very much a Renaissance man in terms of bringing in an eclectic mix of ideas. Notwithstanding his problems in Korea and the hubris that really kicked in, I always admired people who took in a wealth of information, really were widely read, and then could bring that to bear to solve problems. You know, in the non-military sense, I always liked Jefferson as a kid because he was a little bit the same way, where he was taking in a whole ram of ideas to do things. I think more recently, interestingly enough, less to do with big ideas is my dad. So my dad, Major General Sam Kem, was a retired officer, class of 56, and I always admired him. Obviously, he's my father, and he obviously meant a lot to me. But in the last couple of years of his life, and then he died about 2 years ago, the number of people that have come up to me and talked about how much he inspired them or did something for them or helped them was really amazing. So at his funeral, he was buried at Arlington. Two of his old aides, one flew from California, one flew from Vermont. They hadn't worked for him in 20 years, and one of them, California, flew out. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Doug Bullard, and says, "I really needed to be here because he meant so much to me." And I had two people I'd never met before in my life that had been in Vietnam and came up to me when my dad was their battalion commander. And one of them lived in Vermont, and he came up, hadn't seen my dad since the Vietnam War, but knew of him and everything else, and said that he had meant so much to him that he decided to stay in and have a career in the military afterwards, and retired as a lieutenant colonel, I think. So it really meant a lot to me when I see people, and it means a lot now, that making a difference in people's lives and inspiring people. And so since it was a personal connection, it's been fairly recent, it really meant a lot to me. And so I think it comes into fruition for me here at the War College sometimes on how do you really make a difference to inspire people around you.
What did they tell you about your father that was special for you?
I think the most telling part was one said he was great at leader development and not doing one size fits all. So the one person mentioned a time when he was working for my dad. I think at the time my dad was the commandant of the engineer school at Fort Belvoir. And he said, a lot of people, we always throw a lot of work on the workhorses, right? Whoever is the best work, the star major, right, the greatest sergeants just get overloaded. And sometimes people get pushed aside that aren't quite so effective, and people have to start to resent it over time. And he said, my dad was really good at bringing along all the people. He would still load up the workhorses, but he would take somebody who didn't really have confidence necessarily to accomplish more, give them just enough to stretch them, probably give them more than they could do, but then check in with them and give them a little boost when they needed it. And so by doing that, those people end up growing 10%, and eventually became very valuable, productive parts of it. as opposed to what we typically do is we, you know, life is busy and we kind of cast off the ones mm-hmm. that aren't working so well. We load up the workhorses and we lose the organizational dynamics. And he just said he was the best he had ever seen at personalizing leadership to people.
That's great. It's hard to do that in the Army, is it not? Just given the size of the organization, the frequency of changes in personnel and whatnot.
No, absolutely. And I think the computer era, the rise of cell phones and all those things can make it a lot harder because we do have the ability to look at more things, absorb more stuff. There's always more data flowing at you from the screen, more information, just like you and I were talking about a few minutes before we got on. So I think it's easy to get distracted. I think the term I use is continuous partial attention. It's very easy to go through life with continuous partial attention, right? You walk into somebody in their office and they're on the computer and you're talking and the phone is ringing and their other phone is vibrating and you really only have half their mind focused on you. So I think it's actually more important than ever than you can't do it to everybody, right? You can't, but you have to really carve out some time to be thinking about how you're going to engage people.
I don't think the information environment is helping us with the continuous partial attention problem. I don't see that getting any easier. Do you have, as a leader now, do you have some overarching principles that guide your approach to leadership? You know, you recently assumed command here at the Army War College in August. Last day of July in 2017. So as you're preparing yourself to come here, you know, I'm curious about your philosophy of leadership or those. Are there some overarching principles that guide you?
That's a hard one because I've now been in the Army for 32 years. I'm coming up on 33. And so it's hard to narrow down to some overarching principle that says, you know, this is the key to success or do this. In terms of buzzwords, I'd probably use three that I typically use a lot when I talk to people. And they really come from a hodgepodge of places. And I used them actually quite a bit at the pre-command course at Fort Leavenworth, my previous job, where I spoke to each of the battalion brigade pre-command courses, probably 20-something over the course of the 2 years I was there. I was the kind of introductory speaker and trying to not give them pearls of wisdom, but mention that you have to have some basis for how you want to operate, kind of philosophically. And a couple come to mind for me. One, interesting enough, sounds kind of funny, which is be kind. So I taught at West Point in 95 to 97, and I was in the social science department. And I come in the first day, and they go, our motto is be kind. And I go, what a strange motto. Right? It just, that's so anti-Army.
Yeah.
Right?
That's why I joined the Army.
Right. No, right. And so, but over time, it really kind of sinks in that it actually is a pretty powerful way to be. When you're in what can be a very cold business, right? As you mentioned earlier, we do move around a lot. You change jobs every year or two. At any given time in the Army unit, in the battalion and below, you have at least a third of the people have been there less than 6 months, right? Because most people aren't more than about 3 years, especially the officers and more senior NCOs tend to move around a lot. Your average new soldier, you know, comes in for a 3 or 4 year enlistment. And so the churn is so much. And so, you know, so how do you focus on people? And the word be kind does not mean be easy, right? It doesn't mean don't have standards, but be professional, right? I mean, teach people dignity and respect. It kind of captures all that in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you can motivate and inspire people. You can hold them accountable, but you can also be kind in doing it. You can look for when someone is struggling a little bit and try to see how can I help a little bit. You can spend a little extra time mentoring or coaching somebody. It all kind of comes together in that way.
That's awesome.
I guess one or two other ones that I come to mind for me is, and I don't think historically we know exactly who was credited for it. Some say Rommel, some say Napoleon, but in the absence of orders, attack, right? I don't think it's explicitly said that way by them, known quote, but I think it's attributed to them. And it makes a lot of sense, and it's actually increasingly important today. You know, in the Napoleonic era, Napoleon would have to give guidance to Marshal Ney or the other, and it's pretty far in advance because they were going to be 30 or 40 miles away by horseback, and it was going to be 8 to 12 hours before you'd get the reports. So giving them the philosophical guidance that I trust you need to go develop the situation, and I trust you to do what you need to do and also be reporting and communicating back to me. I think that lost a little favor in the last 30 or 40 years in a lot of ways because we've gone to where we have almost continuous contact.
Yeah.
Right? When I was Lieutenant Germany, we still had FM radios. We had the new mobile subscriber system where you could use your phone in a Humvee or a vehicle. And you could maybe, if the network was working, you know, talk to your boss. But But otherwise, you spent a lot of hours when you were not in contact. And now we're always in contact, right? So bosses are used to calling you. You don't have to think ahead because I can always call you, right? But now we're getting to the point with the ability to jam telecommunications, all the craziness and hacking of the world, where we're going to go back to going, no, I trust you. Develop the situation in the absence of orders, go attack and do good things. And so we're probably getting back to that. I mean, the army operating concept and the thought process behind multi-domain battle in a complex world, all those things kind of require that kind of philosophy. So that would be the second one.
I mean, this is mission command, right? I mean, it's an interesting, I like that. I haven't actually ever heard that articulation of it, but it seems like that is a nice way to summarize the principles of mission command. Yet we do struggle, it seems, where I think given the size of the organization globally, when you have limited forces engaged, there is going to be a temptation, not just for the immediate commander, but pretty high up the chain to remain kind of involved in decision making. And I'm curious how you can balance that as an organization when tactical elements are making strategic choices.
Right. It's probably partially a function of we haven't been faced with multiple dilemmas near simultaneously, right? So as you said, when you only have a few people engaged, a small element, or only in one place at any given time, then the whole chain all the way up into the National Security Council could be going, I wonder what's going on with the first squad of the first platoon. You contrast that with during the Korean War, during World War II particularly, we have better communication, obviously, now, but the breadth of things going on, you couldn't have done justice. Gee, I wonder what's going on in Burma today and in the islands and all over Europe and North Africa and Italy. You couldn't have absorbed it all. And we haven't really faced those multiple dilemmas militarily near simultaneously. So we get out of practice and it's easy to micromanage. So I think that's part of the challenge. I think it probably brings up the third of my kind of buzzwords, which is attributed to Mario Andretti. Which is, if you feel like you're in control, you're not going fast enough. And it makes sense for Mario Andretti. You know, if you're a race car driver, if you're not really going at just about the fastest the car will go before it will explode into the wall, you have no chance of winning. You might as well not be driving on the track. I think it applies very well for the United States Army because you do have the sense of, you know, how much do you want to control? And you recognize if you're trying to control everything, and you can kind of control things at a lower level. At the lieutenant or captain level, you can almost pull the strings on 100 people and get away with it, right? Not that you should, but you could. Now make it 4,000 people. Make it the 101st Airborne Division Air Assault. Make it the 82nd. Make it the 1st Armored Division. Now raise it up to the Corps. Raise it up to the Chief of Staff of the Army level. You can't pull the string on all those people. Your brain can't handle it. So, and anytime you're pulling the string on people, that's slowing them down a little bit. That's a little bit of a drag. It doesn't mean you shouldn't pull some strings, right? But if you're trying to manage everything and tell everybody what to do all day, then you've gone too far. And you're slowing down the organization, right? A truly innovative place doesn't have a string on everybody. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have a string in a few places, right? As a leader, you can sometimes anticipate where you need to put attention. You can, like we as parents can anticipate when you first take a kid in the car and you first merge onto the highway for the very first time with your teenage kid and you can just like you're gripping that you wish you were driving and they're pulling down on the highway and you can see the truck's in a bad place. You can kind of anticipate it. They can't, right? So as a leader, there's times you can anticipate you want to be very involved. You can actually be kind of controlling in certain places, but only one or two and for a certain reason. And you communicate that. But unfortunately, a lot of people... And I think that's what we're trying to work on here at the War College is you can get away with that as a captain, maybe as a major. You start moving up, you can't. You're now transitioning here from being an operational leader, strategic leader. How do you let go of the reins and feel comfortable if you've only been comfortable being in control?
It's interesting, though, because you to do what Andretti suggests, you still have to have a kind of philosophy of risk, right? Where there are some risks worth taking. And when someone takes those risks... and it doesn't work out, there aren't necessarily career-ending kind of consequences. How do you inculcate that appropriate... So in mission command, they say prudent risk, which I always think is hilarious. It's like, because risk doesn't have like this arrow pointing at it that says, this risk is prudent. But, you know, how do you teach people to accept that kind of risk organizationally, where you're giving people underneath your in your command space to make decisions where they might incur some organizational risk that you're responsible for, and it may not work out. But in hindsight, you sort of say, you know what, given the information you had at the time, I get it, and I'm not going to punish you for that.
Well, I think it comes back to the communication part, and it's what we work on here at the Army War College, all the war colleges do. I know it's focused on at the Command General Staff College at the operational level, which is the role of a leader to visualize and describe. And we really don't spend enough time probably thinking about that consciously. I gave commander's intent. Did you really visualize and describe and paint a good picture for what you want accomplished? Not just on a battlefield, but visualize and describe in back in the United States when you're preparing for a training center or whatever else you're working on. Because if you visualize and describe, then they will operate within that trade space pretty well. And then as long as they're doing that, you've outlined the risk. If you find yourself saying low, medium, and high risk and using those terms a lot, you've already messed up, right? Because that's kind of goofy language, right? That makes it sound like it's a math formula. I would equate a little bit to if you visualize and describe that you're going to the North Pole as a group, and you're not going to hit the North Pole. You know you won't, right? But magnetic north is okay. You're in the Arctic Circle. If you visualize and describe where those kind of bounds are, you're fine. And that's increasingly important when we're going to have less, communication you can't rely on, GPS you can't rely on, all this complexity. It becomes more important than ever.
So as you think about your own career as an Army officer and the experiences that you've had along the way, operationally, educationally, in various key developmental positions, what are the things that as you look back were maybe most important to your own development? Because the Army, like other military services, we don't really do lateral hires at senior levels, right? We grow our own leaders. So what was important for you?
I've been very fortunate. I've had a pretty diverse career path. And so even though I've been in four divisional units, as a lieutenant, captain, major, and lieutenant colonel, I also had the opportunity to divert off and do a couple of different things. And so I'll highlight just a couple. I was on the Boeslager team when I was a lieutenant, the 7th Corps. That's the NATO Cavalry Cup they used to have. Eight-person team. We trained between 6 and 8 months every day except for Sunday. A small team of eight, and it was about eight different. It was kind of the Cavalry Olympics. And it was an amazing effort. I mean, we had a helicopter that came up every Tuesday and picked me up because I had to do an aerial reconnaissance as part of this competition. So every Tuesday, pilot would fly in. I'd get in the seat and practice aerial reconnaissance. We would go out every Friday night and do a 10-mile land nav, 8 to 10-mile land nav course in the dark, looking for certain points in the middle of nowhere. And did that
every
relentlessly.
Every Friday night?
Every Friday night. and that was a team of, privates, one corporal myself. It showed me what, when you get to train and you really get to focus, how good you get, how good a unit can be. So I think that really built my training part. Now, no one ever gets that many resources unless you're going for the Canadian Armor Trophy, the old Cat Trophy, other kind of things. We don't have that much time. But it does show you what people are capable of when you focus. I think the next one for me would be when I going off to grad school and teaching at West Point allowed me to kind of open up my aperture a little bit. It's great to be around people that aren't wearing green, mm-hmm. right? It teaches you things. You learn what smart people there are in the world, right? We have a lot of smart people in the Army, but you can get pretty narrow in tunnel vision. And just that aperture of what other, be around other great people. I did a congressional fellowship in 2000. I was on the Senate Appropriations Committee subcommittee as a professional staff member for the year. And that was just amazingly broadening, right? Not just watching how the Army and DOD interact with Congress, but just the opportunity to watch Senator Inouye and Senator Stevens, who were the chairman of the ranking, operate. And just gave me an amazing viewpoint on how defense and our country runs. I think those are probably some of the biggest ones for me.
What's the challenge for the Army to provide those kinds of broadening opportunities? Like you described, you have obviously an outstanding civilian graduate experience. How does the Army kind of encourage that while at the same time, because you also mentioned training, right? So there's obviously a tension, right, between having officers who are out doing these interesting things that are maybe not core to the current operational needs of the organization and readiness.
It's a big challenge because of the focus on trying to be ready for more higher end conflicts, right? By us, the 15 to 18 years in Iraq and Afghanistan were difficult, a lot of difficult campaigning, hard battles, a lot of soldiers lost their lives and other servicemen and women. But I think the hard part was it wasn't against an enemy that was doing high end. We weren't getting massive artillery barrages. Mm-hmm. We didn't have aviation flying at us. We didn't have drones. So the Army has a big focus to get back to readiness. And it's not something you build in a day or two. It's a 5 to 7 year effort to get back to some of those skills. The challenge is we have to watch out for overcorrection, right? That does take an increased number of repetitions in doing things. Because if you didn't see it as a lieutenant or captain and now you're a major in a battalion and you're supposed to be developing others, or you're the brigade commander coming out of the Army War College and you walk into a brigade of 4,000 people and most of them really don't know what that kind of high-end warfare is like, it's a long road to get back to it. Because you really need to do it not just once, but you need to do it at a couple different echelons. You know, if the major's got to see it as a captain, we'll be okay. They don't have to have seen it as a lieutenant. Eventually, you catch up. Hmm. And so the Army is really focused intently on that for the right reasons. The challenge we have to make sure is, and I think the Army's trying to make sure we don't lose those other opportunities so that you don't turn around 6 or 7 years from now and go, well, now we're back to being ready for high end, but we've lost the broadening. And so you have to have both. And so you have to have a path and a system that allows a little bit of both. I think the biggest challenge is in the combat arms, probably more so for my infantry brethren than others, because depending on if we tend to pick our own a little bit. And so if you say, well, you really can't be a great brigade commander unless you were also at a combat training center as an observer controller. And you should have also been a deputy G3. And you should have also been, well, those 2 or 3 years.
Now you've got no time for broadening.
Right. Other than the mandatory captain major jobs, those extra 2 or 3, those are the ones you've lost. So.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned earlier two leaders that you've admired. And MacArthur, I think, is a fascinating one. Such a controversial figure. You described how Jefferson and MacArthur were both extremely broad themselves in terms of just their intellectual interests. As a general officer now, what are some of the things that have surprised you about the context of leadership at the senior level? Is there something that you kind of didn't anticipate?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
That's okay.
It's hard because it's hard to figure out where certain things you experience certain things at certain places.
Yeah.
I had never been in an institutional educational side of the Army. So when I first arrived at Fort Leavenworth, even though I'd been a student in the class, to then come in, and I have ideas on what should be done, but to sit there and try to figure, I wonder where this ought to go. What does educational methodology say about adult education and where it ought to be? I didn't have any background in that. Now, we have great faculty here at the War College, at Fort Leavenworth, who think about that part. But you're walking to something where you're going, well, I remember I sat in the class 12 years ago. And, I had some good instructors, some okay instructors. I don't think I ever had any bad instructors. But trying to get your head around and go, okay, I need to go do some homework again so I can – I'm not going to be the expert, but I need to know enough to help guide the organization and be able to pull the ideas out from it. You're reaching into a great faculty. You're reaching across the Army. Same token, you're also supposed to bring some of the, I'll call it the regreening back to it. Recent experience from the force. What is the force looking for in Army War College graduates and the joint staff in the National Security Council? And so I think a big role I have is to try to keep figuring that out and keep it current. That's not easy to do because you don't feel sometimes like you have the background in that. Are you comfortable not being the expert? Right, it kind of comes back to that control part. Up through lieutenant colonel, a brigade commander, battalion commander, you really are the expert in your organization in a lot of ways. Now, I'm not a signal officer, never been one, but I'm pretty confident I could walk into a signal battalion and give reasonable guidance on training, maintaining physical fitness. I will never be the expert at the radio and the telecom, but you don't have to be, right? But you could give enough to feel comfortable in the job. When you come into some of these strange jobs, imagine, an infantry brigade commander gets selected to go be one of the deputy at test command. Well, now you're into statistics and confidence intervals and technology levels, and we do that to people. And so are you comfortable that you have to do your own homework, but you don't have to be the expert? And a lot of people, I think, they struggle with that a little bit because you're used to being the expert, but you can't be, right? There's no way you can be the expert in all the things in a large organization.
Yeah, you have to sort of learn how to learn quickly, but at the same time, as you mentioned earlier, with being willing to rely on those who really bring that expertise, because there's just so much expertise that is required.
Right. It really comes into play as we focus on, you know, lots of focus in the OpMap that helps guide us from the joint staff on science and technology at more colleges and at staff colleges. We all, you know, technology is ubiquitous. How much do leaders need to know so they're comfortable, you know, adapting to new technologies? And because you can't be an expert, right?
No.
If you want to become an artificial intelligence expert, right, you're going to go off to grad school for many, many years, and you're going to have to devote your rest of your career to do that, to stay current in that field, right? This isn't the Jeffersonian Library of 1800 when in that one couple big rooms, you know, that was most of the knowledge of the world.
Yeah, it's sometime, I can't remember who wrote this, but sort of sometime in the 18th century was the last person who sort of knew everything that was known. And then ever since then, the amount of knowledge that we've had has exceeded the capacity of one person. Whether that's true or not is kind of beside the point, but your broader point about Jefferson's library and, you know, what kind of a library we would need today to accommodate everything that is known and relevant, I mean, it's just, we can't do it.
So it also comes back to the, you know, in our profession and the ethics about, you know, humility and all those things. You have to be humble enough to recognize when you don't know something. And it's okay to raise your hand, even as a colonel or general or an SES, to go, hey, I have no idea what you're talking about. Right? That's okay. People don't think less of you. They actually think more of you. But it's not our nature sometimes.
Well, ignorance is not generally perceived as a strength.
Exactly.
But you've got to, I mean, you have to acknowledge it to learn, right? I mean, at some level, ignorance is really powerful if we can be willing to ask those questions.
But most of us are kind of wired not to be that way in some ways, right? The best example, I think, is adults versus kids with languages, right? You know, kids learn languages, great. Why do they really learn languages? Because they're willing to say things that are backwards.
Yeah.
And it sounds funny, and people will snicker a little bit, and they don't even hear it. They're just, you know, having fun. Whereas adults, I don't want to say it unless I got it perfect, because I wouldn't want somebody to think I don't know what I'm doing. When you're going, well, I can't speak Chinese, but why would you expect to be perfect at it? But we kind of have that little facade we have of, you know, wanting to show control and, you know, always doing well.
So my last question, and if there's anything else you want to share, we can talk about that too. But my last question has to do with a survey you recently ran here at the War College, where you're asking the community for recommendations regarding books that they felt would be especially good for officers at various stages of their career development. And I was wondering for you, if there are some books that you felt were really outstanding, helpful for you at different stages, early, middle, kind of more recent senior level. You know, what would you recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I think I can only give you a partial answer because
you don't want to give away your...
No. This was an experiment. You know, the traditional way you come up with book reading lists is the people who really care, you know, get around a coffee table or get a few beers and you sit in a room and you start arguing over whiteboard or whatever else and you come up with the 60. But that's really only got the ideas of the five of you. And so we're trying to, you know, use a little social media support and open up wider where people could comment on a variety of books and vote and those kind of things. And it's been interesting. The hard part about it is there's a whole bunch of books I've never even heard of, which is great. The other hard part is going to be, how do we now ratchet that down? Because they're, you know, I'm not going to go read all of them. I wouldn't have time to do it. So it's an interesting part where you go that we got the brain power of many people here to help package it. Now we have to cull it. And even the voting doesn't quite do that because we all tend to vote for the ones we kind of know or have heard of. There's some we've never heard of, so how do you really vote?
Or the books you recommended.
I actually didn't put one on there. No, I actually had a joke one on there. I was the first one on the experimentation I put on Clausewitz, and then I wrote a little sentence, and I said, he's kind of obscure, right? I kind of prefer Jomini. And no one ever came back and goes, no, you're crazy. But I am an avid reader in spurts, so I will do a whole bunch for 3 months and then not a lot for two or three. And so I just trying to think before I came in about a couple of them. I think from my grad school days, getting to yes about negotiations, which is one of the traditional famous ones, only because that's what, you know, we tend to think of in the military as negotiations as being over a, you know, a contract or something else. But it's really about negotiating all the time. Solving problems is negotiations.
That's a fundamental leadership activity. It really is.
Absolutely. But in the military side, we tend to think of it as you're doing it for a purpose as
I'm
opposed to...
I'm in a negotiation.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So that one really came to mind from my grad school days. Historically, Grant's memoirs, I read.
Oh, I love that book.
And
it's great.
It was just fantastic. And I think that was one of the first books I ever read that really brought to light the challenges of national level leadership and those things. And it was just interesting.
My favorite part of that book is where Grant is describing the night before he's going to negotiate with Lee at Appomattox. He's got a really bad cold and he can't sleep. And he's got some kind of mustard plasters on, you know, some horrible like remedy from the period. He's soaking his feet, I think, in warm water. And of course, Grant on his best day looked like a little rumpled, but here you have the leader of the Union Army feels horrible. You know, I think when we imagine these historic events, you know, you see the paintings of Lee and Grant, and they're not really human, you know?
Right.
And it just really brought home his humanity that here's a guy, he's kind of a normal person who's doing all these extraordinary things, but he's a normal person. And then when he goes in, he feels self-conscious because Lee, of course, is maybe the most military looking figure of all time, you know, and Grant was not. And there was a little bit of an inferiority complex that it's evident in his description. I mean, it's really wonderful, his humanity. I mean, his willingness to talk about himself in a way that is not, you can tell he's not just trying to build the myth.
No, absolutely. You're right. Because Lee really was the personification of excellence.
Yes.
I think I remember I was at a West Point Founders Day one time for it, and they had a quiz contest, and one of the questions was, who's the only cadet known to have graduated with no demerits? And it's Robert E. Lee. Not a single one in his 4 years. But the quiz question was, how many were on his demerit page back in the old days, and they handwrote everything, and they had some number, and I didn't know the answer, but it's because the guy next to him in the book had so many they had to use part of Lee's page to fill the void. So he had this model of perfection that I think Grant was leading with. But you're right. I think the humility was amazing in that. I was fortunate enough recently to get the book. It's not quite out yet. Ori Brofman and General Dempsey have a new book coming out.
Oh, really?
Called Radical Inclusion. I think it's coming out next month. And I used to work with General Dempsey. He just sent me an advance copy. So I read it last week. And it was interesting. It's really talking about what post 9/11 should have taught us.
Right,
about how to include people. That's an interesting book just because it's recently in my head.
Radical Inclusion.
Radical Inclusion. So look for that coming out shortly. And then in a non-military or non-other things, there's a book I read, I reread it recently called The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. It's kind of a science fiction mystery, kind of Lord of the Rings mix. The reason I like it is it's such an amazing storytelling. And one of the things that I've kind of learned, I really got it from General Perkins. He talked about how leaders need to use stories more and analogies to help you explain. If you want to visualize and describe, mm-hmm. instead of just using words, you have to paint a picture. And I was reading this book, and the ability for that author to use prose to paint a picture is really kind of amazing. So that's just a couple of examples.
Well, and fiction is often not well represented on professional reading lists. And in the Great Books course that we teach here at the War College, we always assign several fiction books. I think one of the greatest values of fiction is it gives you an opportunity to learn empathy in a really novel way. I mean, in history, you can't really inhabit another human mind, right? You just can't. No historian can ever do that. But a great novelist. A couple of years ago in the course, we read Emile Zola's Germinal, which is a novel about a French coal mining town and a strike. And in the opening chapter, the protagonist goes into the mine, and it is an incredible description of this work environment that is horrendous. It's a fantastic work of not just fiction, but sort of journalistic fiction. And I remember in our discussion with the officers in the course, they were talking about how much the book sort of altered their perspective about that old conflict between labor and management, right? Which, you know, I mean, that's, I think the power of fiction is to really cause us to take somebody else's perspective, even if we don't have to adopt it, but just to kind of assume it for a little while. I think that, and it gets to your original, your first overarching principle about being kind to others. I think oftentimes it's easier to be kind to others when we try to see the world sort of as they see it or experience it.
No, I think it's a great point. I'd never really thought about the empathy side, but it makes perfect sense. And, you know, the storytelling part that I mentioned, in the end, it's about, you know, we can sometimes get too serious, right? We are in serious business, but every book doesn't have to be, you know, Thucydides and then Clausewitz and all this slogging through, you know, tough material, right? Yeah. You know, life's also supposed to be fun. We can have a little mix because you still grow from all of them.
Well, sir, thank you so much for joining us today in this discussion in the War Room. And we really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy. As we mentioned, leaders have a lot to do. So thank you, sir, very much.
Oh, no, thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Thank you for joining us in the War Room today, and we hope you'll join us next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.